From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, how technology will affect our future. Here's what's happening. Well, they're still going at it. More than 12 hours now, the Republican-controlled U.S. Senate blocking Democratic attempts to obtain evidence and call a witness in President Donald Trump's impeachment trial. An early sign the proceeding could advance on lines favorable to Mr. Trump. As the third presidential impeachment trial in U.S. history began, President Trump's chief legal defender described the case as a baseless effort to overturn the 2016 election, while a top Democratic lawmaker said there was overwhelming evidence of wrongdoing. And like I said, they're still doing it. It's more than 12 hours now. Nothing really has been accomplished yet on this first day. The United States has confirmed the first case of the new coronavirus on its territory. The Centers for Disease Control said the virus, which originated in China, had been diagnosed in a U.S. resident who arrived in Seattle from China. The virus, which spread from the Chinese city of Wuhan, has infected almost 300 people there. Six have died. North Korea has already closed its borders to foreign tourists in response to the threat. We'll keep our eyes on this story and look for some immunologists to talk about that. Wall Street lost ground, backing away from the record highs as this viral outbreak from China found its way to U.S. shores, and the International Monetary Fund lowered its global economic growth forecast. Everybody seems to be concerned about that. The Fed is adding just over $90 billion in temporary money to markets. They added the money in two repurchase agreements or repos, $90 billion. Let's check in with business leader Chuck Gopis on all of this. Chuck, things seem to be strong, but what's your impression?
Well, you know, you just mentioned the Fed interventions, and that's what we've had. The GDP growth for last year was 2%, I think. They're going to just confirm that next week, and it's about the same for next year. That's not really the 4 or 6% that Trump had promised in the campaign. But, you know, most people look at the stock market, which is really a bad measure for the economy, as you know, and now the Fed is inflating these financial assets through the repo facility. They've been providing billions of dollars, and there's no we don't know who the recipients are, and it's very very non-transparent. And this is pushing stocks to new highs, of course. 150% of GDP, I've mentioned that before. Normal's around 70%. And so it's here we are at 1929 earnings to ratio levels, and that's just not normal. We've been 11 years in this thing, and all of this is really just encouraging risk, as you can see, around the world. And the you just mentioned... mentioned that the IMF is even comparing the economy to the Roaring Twenties. Something like a global depression could happen. So, need to be very wary about this. Most of the new poll by Newsweek, 97% of chief financial officers see a recession this year.
Boy.
I'm sure they're discussing this at the Davos Economic Forum this week. We live in strange times, George.
We sure do, Chuck. Keep in touch. Chuck Oppus's website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. I urge you to always go out there and just look at some of the things we've got out there. Uber Technologies, Uber, is testing a new feature that would allow some drivers in California to set their fares. It's the latest in a series of moves to give them more autonomy in response to the state's new gig economy law, which makes workers, even 1099 workers, employees. Now, what if a stranger could snap your picture on the sidewalk, then use an app to quickly discover your name, address, and other details? Well, a startup company called Clearview AI has made that possible, and its app is currently being used by hundreds of law enforcement agencies in the U.S., including the FBI. Now, the app works by comparing a photo to a database of more than 3 billion pictures that Clearview says it's scraped off Facebook, Venmo, YouTube, and other sites. It then serves up matches along with links to the sites where those database photographs originally appeared. Our expert on the Internet, Lauren Weinstein, is with us. This is kind of scary, Lauren.
Well, it was kind of inevitable, too. Yeah, what Clearview reportedly did is they've been scraping publicly available photos from social media and other sites. Now, these are photos that people have been happily uploading for years of themselves and their children and such without a thought for the privacy implications. And then Clearview worked up some pretty advanced facial recognition algorithms, and they pretty quietly made this available to law enforcement. Now, it's interesting to note that the terms of service of at least some of these social sites actually prohibit scraping photos this way and using them this way. But as a practical matter, there's no technical method to stop it at this point. Now one could say, I haven't done anything wrong. I think it's great for law enforcement to use facial recognition to catch crooks. But, of course, we all know this kind of technology eventually gets into the hand of ordinary people and crooks and perverts and the type of folks who would very much like to have a surprise visit with a woman they saw on the street and was able to figure out their home address. Technology like this, see them on the street, snap them with your phone camera, the address pops up, and you get the idea.
Now, is this Clearview app, Lauren, available for anybody or just law enforcement?
Right now, it's just law enforcement, but the history of technology tells us this is not going to stay that way. And there's growing concern about the abuse of facial recognition systems. There's some laws governing it now, or even banning it outright, at least in theory. And it's certain there's going to be many more laws like this. But has there ever been a technology that can be abused that hasn't leaked out and ended up actually being abused? So personally, I'm of the belief that stuffing this particular genie back into the bottle is likely a hopeless task in the long run. We can do what we can try, but this kind of technology is going to march forward. In the meantime, you might want to reconsider everybody who posts public photos of themselves to these social media sites of their children and their friends. You got to think about who might eventually get a hold of them and what they might end up being used for.
Crazy stuff. Thanks, Lauren. Appreciate it. Up next, Mitch Horowitz joins us. Secrets of Self-Mastery, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest, Mitch Horowitz, back with us. Mitch, of course, is an expert in the occult, esoteric ideas. He is a well-known author. His latest work is called Secrets of Self-Mastery. And here he is for a couple hours on Coast to Coast. Welcome back, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, George. Great to be here.
Secrets of Self-Mastery. Tell me about that title. What does that mean?
Well, I really wanted to boil down metaphysical methods and ideas in ways that people could use in their day-to-day lives to improve their health, to improve their appearance, to improve their charisma, to improve their earning power. We all have needs in this life. We shouldn't be embarrassed about them, and I wanted to see what I could do to help people meet them.
What is personal power?
Personal power, George, is, I think, having the ethical means to accomplish what you want in the world, to see through what you want, whatever it may be. You could be a soldier, a scholar, an activist, an artist, whatever it is.
A puppet, a poet, right?
Anything. We all have things that we wish to get done in the world, and finding the means to get those things done in a way that is ethical, in a way that respects the rights of others, that's my definition of power.
Now, is that personal power, does it get drained sometimes?
Oh, without question. The number one way that personal power gets drained is when we spend time around other people who don't support us, and that's one of the reasons why I advise people perhaps the number one step they could take to improve their sense of personal power is to distance themselves from friends, coworkers, relatives, whoever it is that they feel either attacked them in some way, usually emotionally, usually through passive aggression. I think we all have to take back our power by not spending time around cruel people. It's perhaps the greatest thing we can do for ourselves.
You take a major life lesson, this is strange, from the gun manufacturer Glock.
Yeah.
Tell me
about
that.
Well, Gaston Glock, whatever one's feelings are about firearms, Gaston Glock was just a tremendous visionary because years ago, the Austrian military put out a call for a new kind of lightweight handgun. And Glock was a guy who had never manufactured firearms before in his life. He had been a manufacturer of curtain rods and field knives. And because he was unencumbered by any prejudices or any ideas of what could or couldn't be done in gun manufacturing, he was able to come up with an incredibly innovative design for a lightweight plastic handgun, which we call the Glock. It revolutionized the munitions industry. And the inspiration that I take from his story is that if you can approach a task, whatever it is, without prejudice or without being encumbered by ideas of what cannot be done, you can unleash a wave of original thinking. That's exactly what Gaston Glock did, and that way of thinking, that way of approaching tasks, is available to all of us.
You know, you're considered the modern-day Napoleon Hill, who was the self-help author of his day. Think and Grow Rich was his big book and work. But you remind me of him, Mitch.
Oh, I appreciate it. That's a great honor to me, because Napoleon Hill, he's been kind of a hero to me, because he, too, was concerned with personal power, but not in a cynical way, in an ethical way, and that's meaningful to me.
When you look at an individual, what are his strengths? What are his weaknesses or hers?
Yeah.
You know, how do they affect other people? You've talked about, you know, what do you do when others are cruel to you and things like that. How does that all affect us?
You know, the number one weakness that I see in people, in addition to hanging around people who are cruel to them, and I think that's task one, you have to get away from people who are cruel to you. If you can't get away from them as a physical fact, at least begin by getting away from them as a mental fact. And at the first possible opportunity, avail yourself of the chance to get away from them physically. That's number one. Number two is do not gossip. Do not denigrate and run down other people, because every time we trash talk, denigrate, spread rumors, run down other people, I'm not talking about objecting to injustice, but exchanging negative stories about people for entertainment. Anytime we do that, we're reenacting those same traits in ourselves. We denigrate ourselves constantly by engaging in trash talk and gossip. And number three, strong people have a definite aim in life. If you have a definite aim in life, you're not going to go off the rails and get mixed up with weak habits and weak behaviors that are going to detract from your personal power. So it's three simple steps. Stay away from cruel people, don't gossip, and have a definite aim. And you will have nobility and personal power.
In the latter part of the show tonight, Mitch, I'm talking with a guest about high technology and how it's going to change us in the future. But one of the things I have found that it has done is the internet has created a whole group of people who normally wouldn't be haters. They'd be nice people when you meet them, but when you get them behind a computer and they're anonymous, they become very wretched. Why?
Exactly. Anonymity is a disinhibitor of the worst kind. You know, we're told that everybody should be entitled to know who bears witness against them. But social media breeds anonymity, and somehow that anonymity taps into the worst aspects of human nature. My simple rule is, don't say anything online that you wouldn't be willing to say to someone's face. And people ruin their lives, they ruin their reputations, they ruin their careers by things they say online, even if they feel protected by anonymity. I'm not so sure anonymity is the name of the game anymore, something you've been talking about on the show. You know, privacy, unfortunately, is becoming kind of a quaint notion in our society. We have to be willing to stand by what we say, and there's too much disinhibition on social media that's brought about by anonymity or a false sense of anonymity.
Was a radio broadcaster in St. Louis who lost his radio and TV job because he tweeted something that I'm not going to repeat that was derogatory, and management at both the radio station and the TV station. He had these two great gigs going. Fired him. He was done.
It's a real problem. It's a real problem. And look, the same is true with texts and emails. I don't know a single person who hasn't sent an email that they regretted sending. And we really have to pause before these things. We need to relearn the lessons of civility in this generation. We are at an artificial remove from the things that we say, things that we would never say to somebody in person or over the phone, we feel at liberty to say online or through emails. And it's a game that we're all going to lose at. You know, the odds are always stacked against us. We have to be really careful, really thoughtful about what we say before we press send.
Mitch Horowitz with us. His latest book is called Secrets of Self-Mastery. His website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You talk about a hidden double that we all have. Tell me about that.
That is the topic that I am most interested in at this point in my search, George. You know, it was funny. I write about this in the new book, Secrets of Self-Mastery. And just the other night, I was speaking with a extremely successful comedian, somebody whose name would be familiar.
We'd all know it,
wouldn't
we? Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
We'd all know the name, wouldn't we?
You'd all know the name, but it was a private conversation, so I won't disclose it. But she was saying to me that her whole life was like a story of before and after based on using this exercise. All of us have a kind of a doppelganger or a plus entity or a stronger double.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out when we say things like, I could get straight A's, I could earn more money, I could get sober. These statements are real. They're true. And if we invite in this stronger plus entity, we will discover that this stronger self that sometimes gets talked about in myth as a shadow or a double really does exist. It can change your whole life. Invite in this stronger self, and you'll be surprised to discover that it's not just metaphor or allegory, it's real. It's something I write about in the new book, and it's something I'm experimenting with myself. I really believe it has the power to revolutionize people's lives.
Can this other self, though, be like Jekyll and Hyde and maybe is a worse part of you?
Well, you're raising a terrific point. It is kind of a Jekyll and Hyde type situation. Although, for the most part, George, I would submit, most of us are walking around more as Mr. Hyde. We're not helping people. We're not helping ourselves. We're not living up to our full potential. We're giving in to what's lowest and what's easiest in us. We get scared of this idea of the other half as if it's evil. But I would say a lot of us are walking around in our lower selves right now, in our minus entities. When we invite in this other self, I believe in most cases, George, we are inviting in the plus entity. There's a risk in everything. I think this is an ethical risk worth taking.
When we take calls next hour with Mitch Horowitz, your questions, of course, and also your stories on some of the things we've talked about, if this has happened to you. We've always talked about doppelgangers, Mitch, on the program, and some people think that they are the evil opposite, again, the Mr. Jekyll and Hyde routine, but definitely the evil opposite of who we are.
Oh, yeah, and I think those stories are real. I think those stories are authentic. But I think what we miss, is that we may be walking around right now as the lesser side, the Mr. Hyde, the dark half, the half that we feel weakened by, the half that we feel challenged by. Imagine the possibility, George, if this other half is our stronger half, is our good half, is our plus half. There's a lot of people out there in tremendous need. There's a lot of people out there who are unhappy. And I would say, in my book, it's worth the risk to say this other half might be the one that we want to invite in. I counsel people about that, and I guide people through that possibility in the new book. It's a possibility that I think is worth exploring.
You have talked about the possibility of what happens when people, and we all do this, suffer disappointment. Something doesn't happen the way we expect it. Yes. How do we handle that?
It's a tough one, and I've been through disappointment myself, and I don't make light of it. But I will say that it is a crucible. It is a method for self-refinement. Every great thinker, every great poet throughout history has made the point that a tough instructor is the only place that gets us anywhere. Rumi said, pray for a tough instructor. Nietzsche said, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. William Blake said, opposition is true friendship. Opposition is what helps us, what makes us more mature. We have to start to look at disappointment as a friend, as resistance training. It will make us stronger. It will make us nobler if we look at it that way. I don't belittle it because I've been through disappointment myself and I know how it can feel, but it's usually there in order to make us to be able to lift greater and greater amounts of weight. Ethically, intellectually, physically.
What do you say to somebody, Mitch, who gets so disappointed they go and get an AR-17 and blast up a school or something because they're disappointed?
I would say to that person, first of all, you know, we are visited by terrible tragedy in life, but the polarity of that is we are also visited by incredible miracles. And if you can wait 24 hours, there is a cyclical quality to life, a cyclical nature to our day-to-day life. I make this as a personal promise to everyone. If you can wait 24 hours, you may find that something extraordinary happens to you that is a complete polarity of the pain and suffering you are experiencing. Call it faith, call it persistence, call it the cycles of nature, whatever you want. But life is a cycle, and we must never give in when we're feeling at our lowest and our darkest.
We're going to come back in just a moment with Mitch Horowitz and talk more about his latest work, Secrets of Self-Mastery, next hour. We open up the phone lines, your stories, your questions. We will take your calls next hour with Mitch Horowitz as we talk about Secrets of Self-Mastery. Share some of your stories with us as well. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, back with Mitch Horowitz. His latest work is called Secrets of Self-Mastery. Mitch, what would you like people to learn the most if they read this book?
I think they can learn that we are capable, with effort, of completely remaking our lives, remaking our personas from the inside out. We are beings that are capable of self-creation. Some of the scripture says we're created in God's image. The Hermetic literature says, as above, so below. I would take these things quite literally. I would take these things quite seriously. And in terms of personality, appearance, charisma, ability, health, we are capable of remaking ourselves. It requires tremendous effort, but it's absolutely real.
You talk about the 10 rules of good luck, and you also talk about the 10-day miracle challenge. Both of those are dear to my heart. What are some of the rules of good luck?
Well, one of the primary rules of good luck is to circulate in the world. Good luck usually meets people that it can reach. It's very important to circulate in the world. It is very important to look for and maintain relationships where you have great chemistry. There are certain artists, like Mick Jagger, for example, who have never really recorded successful solo albums, but when they're in their chemistry group, for Mick, it's the Rolling Stones, they're incredibly successful.
They're giants.
Look for areas in your life where there's remarkable chemistry. Make decisions quickly. You will more often than not be glad, be satisfied, be happier if you make decisions quickly. One of the harbingers of bad luck is to ruminate endlessly on things. So those are three rules that I think people can live by.
What about miracles? The 10-day miracle challenge.
Absolutely. Miracles are real. I define a miracle very simply as a fortuitous departure from all expected circumstance. And one of the reasons why we overlook miracles in our lives is because sometimes they reach us in ways that are very unexpected. Ancient myth, religious parables, ethical parables all tell stories of gods or angels meeting people described as strangers. We very often dismiss miracles in our lives because they reach us disguised as strangers. They come in ways that we don't recognize. So the 10-day miracle challenge, very simply, is naming something that you really, really wish for and really need in your life. It might be something very urgent, financial, health-related, something else. Mark off 10 boxes for 10 days where you really focus on what you want. And the rub is, you have to watch very, very carefully, because what you want may reach you in a way that is completely unexpected, that is completely unlike whatever your mind's eye image is of how the solution may come. If you do that for 10 days and you watch very vigilantly, you may very well be met with something extraordinary. It's a major practice that I use in my life.
You have also used going to bed, thinking about, affirmations right before you go to bed. I've used that too. I think it's very powerful.
It's extremely powerful. Just before we fall to sleep at night, we enter into a state that sleep researchers call the hypnagogic state. The hypnagogic state is basically prime time for psychical activity, for self-suggestion, for self-hypnosis. It's a time where the mind is very flexible, very malleable, and if you can use that period of time to affirm, to prayer, to visualize, you can reprogram your psyche. It's really extraordinary, and we all enter this hypnagogic state twice, just as we're going to sleep at night, just as we're waking up in the morning. We enter it twice every single day, and it can be used, and it should be used, as prime time for visualizations and affirmations.
How does it work? What takes over to make these things happen?
It seems to work because the rational apparatus of the mind is down. We are not necessarily thinking in terms of logic, in terms of analysis, but we're still conscious, we're still cognizant. Now, this is also one of the reasons why people who suffer from grief or depression sometimes describe the wee hours of the morning as the most difficult time of day, because this rational apparatus is down and we're not able to see things proportionally. But as much as that can be a painful time of day, it can also be a very helpful time of day, because for the same reason, if our rational apparatus is down, we can also use that as a time of day to introduce idealized self-suggestions, idealized qualities, visualizations, affirmations that we want to use to boost our confidence, to reprogram our minds. And serious psychical researchers have found that this time of day where we're drowsy but still cognizant is prime time for ESP-related activity, because there's not this kind of background noise, this habitual thinking going on that kind of burdens us all day. It's an extraordinary period of time. We don't really fully understand what's going on with it, but it's definitely prime time for self-suggestion.
You talk about how people should stop complaining. Tell me about that.
Oh, that is one of the greatest things we can do to help ourselves. You know, so many of our conversations, George, are composed of complaining. People complaining about service in restaurants or traffic or the air conditioning or, you know, just a problem they're having with somebody at work. But even worse is that a great deal of our inner talking is composed of complaining. And we spend so much time of day, including when we're alone, complaining internally, that we are conditioning ourselves to view life from a negative perspective. It affects our relationships, it affects our health, it affects our stress levels, it affects how we see ourselves as individuals capable of dealing with problems in the world. Trying to stop complaining is incredibly powerful. And once you begin to try, you'll realize how much of our internal talking, which is to say our internal self-suggestion, is composed of complaining. It's one of the greatest things and simplest things that we can do for ourselves.
You also value forgiveness. Tell me about that, because that's a tough one.
It is a very tough one, George, and I have struggled with it, because people are victims of injustice in this world sometimes. They are mistreated by people who are supposed to care for them, and I don't minimize how painful that is. But I have a principle, which is you become what you don't forgive. When we don't forgive something, we make it into a pattern in our lives. It becomes a kind of self-suggestion. It becomes a kind of self-imposed auto-suggestion in our lives. So forgiving other people is something that's not necessarily doing a favor for them so much as it's doing a favor for ourselves, because we don't want to repeat the patterns of things that can be that have been visited upon us. I acknowledge the pain. I acknowledge the injustice. But if we don't want to repeat those things to others in our lives, the best thing we can do is to make the effort to forgive.
Mitch, since you've been doing this, have you seen a difference with yourself?
Oh, without question, without question. But the important thing, George, is less the difference that I see in myself than the difference that others see in me. My wish is that people who are around me would see me as somebody who's easier to live with, easier to be around, who's more fortifying, who's more nourishing to other people. Life is relationships. Life is relationships. So I would look to other people around me to respond to that question better than I could myself.
You have a two-word formula for power. What is that?
The two-word formula for power is a definite aim. Definite aim. If you have a definite aim in life, that is the greatest guarantor of power, because when you have a definite aim in life, it keeps you from getting distracted. It keeps you from just kind of wasting your time with people, with relationships, with idle things that are unproductive. If you can adopt a definite aim in life that you adhere to with passionate intensity and even an obsessional quality, it will keep you from going off the rails and wasting your time listening to, watching, participating in frivolous things. It will keep you focused on what really matters to you in life. Having a definite aim is the greatest guarantor of power.
Why has the Chinese government censored your work?
Isn't that something?
That's weird.
I have a book called One Simple Idea, which is a history of the positive mind movement. It was licensed by a Chinese publisher in the city of Shanghai. Everything was going just fine. And then just before publication, the publisher contacted me and said government censors had cut about one-third of the book. It turns out that Chinese government censors are very suspicious of any kind of metaphysical or mystical ideas. The idea that we participate in a life that's extra physical, that's transcendent, whatever you may call it. You can call it God, you can call it religion, you can call it infinite intelligence, ESP, any idea that we participate in a life that goes beyond the material is considered threatening by the Chinese government, because they want the government and the central party to have complete control and allegiance over the public's life. And if you have interests, mystical, religious, spiritual, that go beyond the physical, they see that as threatening. They cut one third out of my book, One Simple Idea. Yeah.
Have they tried to get your Facebook taken out of China?
No, I'm afraid to check. You know, I would bet that they have. And, you know, it's been a strange experience because, you know, China today obviously has a kind of business-friendly environment. And the publisher wanted to put out my book in Mandarin because they thought it would feed into that business-friendly environment, which I suppose it does. But that business-friendly environment stops very, very abruptly when you start to talk about self-improvement ideas that involve anything spiritual or mystical. They find that threatening. And as a result, they chopped a third out of my book.
One of our special guests, Joseph Gallenberger, does experiments with luck. And he takes groups of people to Las Vegas, Mitch, divides them into two, upbeat,
yes,
happy, and people who are depressed and not. And he separates them. And he says almost all the time, the people who are upbeat and happy come back winners, where the other people who are down and depressed on purpose come back as losers.
Yes.
Why does positive thinking like that seem to work?
It's really extraordinary, and what he's observed is supported by serious ESP research. My hero is a man named J.B. Ryan, who was an ESP researcher.
Oh, sure. Duke University, right?
Duke University. And J.B. was just brilliant, and he labored for decades to assemble statistics that proved the existence of ESP. And J.B. made the observation that one of the great correlates to an individual displaying some kind of extrasensory ability was hopeful expectancy. Hopeful expectancy. He found that if hopeful expectancy was present in the subject, results would spike. If the subject was bored or depressed or just disinterested in the experiments, inevitably the results would dip. And hopeful expectancy also is a trigger in placebo experiments. If we can learn, George, to cultivate hopeful expectancy, we seem to be able to heighten the selective powers of the mind.
Since you've been doing this, Mitch, have you seen people change for the better?
I have seen people change for the better, but I will say that it requires a great deal of effort. Everything in our lives conspires to take our attention from us. We are denied quiet time. We are denied meditative time. We are denied respite. Everything in life almost conspires to take our attention. But if the individual is passionately determined to improve his or her status in life from within, I've never seen a failure. I've never seen a failure. It just requires tremendous drive and effort.
It sure does. Now, you have also talked about a weakness that we have within ourselves and that we must identify it. How do you do that?
It is profoundly important to identify what I call your definite chief weakness. I spoke about having a definite aim, but it's also important to identify your definite chief weakness. And this requires a great deal of self-scrutiny. Sometimes it requires asking other people that we're close to and that we trust what they think. Because there is always a polarity living within us. We are beings who live at dual ends of a stick, so to speak. It's natural. It's human nature. And as we all have a definite strength, we have a countervailing definite weakness. And identifying that definite weakness is something that very, very few people ever venture to do in life, and it can be painful. It's almost almost always fear-based. It's almost always based in paranoia. It's almost always based in maybe having had some sort of insufficient bond with our parental figures, and that makes us scared that somehow we're going to lose relationships, lose opportunities in the here and now. And we speak of these things in kind of analytic terms, whereas really what's going on is very emotional. And we have to identify that chief weakness in us. Again, usually it arises from an insecure bond in childhood. And it can be very painful, and it can mark our whole lives. But identifying it brings a kind of cleansing illumination to it. It's profoundly important.
You've been writing a major new article on UFOs and strange creatures and things. Tell me about that.
That's right. That's coming out in the March-April issue of New Dawn magazine. I've been studying UFO sightings. I've been studying testimony that people have given around spotting strange creatures, whether it's Bigfoot or Yeti or some other so-called mythical creature, but creatures that have assembled a great deal of testimony and sometimes empirical evidence. And I'm persuaded that there's a connection between the mental selectivity that we're talking about and the appearance of UFOs and strange creatures, and it's this. I believe that everything in life is in a state of superposition, and we experience very, very little of what's going on in our five-sensory existence. But there are other things happening around us that are altogether real, altogether empirical, altogether authentic, that we capture sometimes through our senses, sometimes through technology, at extraordinary moments. And there's a kind of mental selectivity going on, not entirely different from what's going on in the particle lab or the quantum physics lab when a subatomic particle is in a state of superposition until someone takes a measurement. Then it collapses into a state of locality. I think the reason we have so much testimony going on around UFOs, around extraordinary beasts, is because at certain moments of extraordinary selectivity, we are able to pick up these things that are going on extra-dimensionally, that are going on in wave states or superposition states, but we, because of a process of what might be called information leakage, because our five senses are quite limited, we're not always able to pick these things up, but they are real and they are authentic. And I think as we understand more about our minds through ESP, through psychical research, through quantum research, through neuroplasticity, we're going to understand more and more about the reality of these sightings. And our perspective is broadening. I think our generation is on an extraordinary precipice of understanding not only the powers of the mind to select circumstance, perspective, experience, but to also see things that are maybe coming into greater focus to our generation than they did to previous generations. We're in a whole new precipice of human perspective and human understanding, and it's including UFOs and strange beasts.
What's your gut tell you about UFOs? Other planetary systems or where?
I think what's happening with UFOs, what my gut tells me is that these things may be extra-dimensional. There may be so many mechanical complexities in terms of ET visitations. I don't rule it out, of course, but I think what we may be experiencing is interdimensional, which is just as extraordinary as anything extraterrestrial associated. But what it suggests is that these things are not necessarily traveling super far distances, but they are appearing to us from other dimensions that are existing alongside our own, that we are from time to time able to localize through profoundly sensitive or exquisite measurement or moments of sensitivity.
Up next, we're going to take your phone calls with Mitch Horowitz. Questions about secrets of self-mastery and perhaps your own story.